from Friday, February 22nd till Sunday, March 3rd. More information is available at 217-728-7375 or online at www.thelittletheater.org.
It's 1240. As politicians debate gun control in Washington and Springfield, we've been running a series from public radio station WBZ in Chicago called Our Guns, about the many reasons that Americans own guns. Hunters and sportsmen have complex relationships to firearms. As Alex Keefe learned on a recent hunting trip, it's part history, part tradition, and part recreation.
So the first thing I learned is that when goose hunters say morning, they mean early. And when they say cold...
Well, it is 6:36 and it's a brisky 8 degrees.
That's Neil Brooks. He runs the Mazonia Hunt Club, a goose hunting outfit in Gardner, Illinois, about an hour southwest of Chicago. It's actually a little generous to call this a club. We've gathered on this bitter morning in a refurbished auto garage, made a bit cozier with hot coffee, old recliners, and walls thick with stuffed animal heads.
We've got ducks, pheasants, a lot of deer that I've shot with bow.
This is the rendezvous point, where the hunters get the blood flowing before going out for game. In this case, Canada geese. Brooks agreed to let me tag along on a hunt with a couple of his clients, so I could hear how hunting informed the way they think about guns and shooting. 32-year-old Mike Blasky, a logistics manager in Lockport, says it all started when he was a boy, going out hunting with his dad.
So once I got old enough, my dad was looking for another hunting partner and took me when I was young, when I was about 7 years old, and I didn't have a gun or anything, but I sat in the blind and watched him.
Tradition and family, it seems, are big parts of hunting.
I recognized as a kid that if I was going to see my father during hunting season, I better be hunting with him.
Scott Early is a 63-year-old retired lawyer, and his story starts the same way, hunting pheasant with his dad and his godfather in southern Illinois.
Once you got started, no matter what you're doing now, you're going to find a way to get back to it. It gets in your blood. And that's where I am now.
As the sun gets higher, everybody pulls on their camouflage outerwear and climbs into an SUV that takes us to the hunting site. The shotguns are stowed in the back of the truck, unloaded. As we drive, I feel like I'm asking the obvious, but I want the hunters to tell me what their guns mean to them.
That would be like saying, how do you regard your golf clubs? The golf clubs are just a means to an end. For me, and I think for a lot of hunters, the enjoyment you get is the process as much as the result.
We finally reach our destination, a harvested cornfield with a long, low hut near one edge, camouflaged by reeds. This is the goose blind, where the hunters sit in folding chairs hidden from the sky so as not to spook the geese and ruin their big shot. Everybody climbs in and gets ready.
Locked and loaded.
Could you introduce us to your gun here? What is it?
This is what's called a Benelli Nova. It's a pump.
Early says he owns a handful of guns. The one with him today is a shotgun covered in camo, the kind of equipment that's made to handle this extreme weather, unlike my own.
You're freezing up?
My palm sweat is freezing on my microphone.
The wind chill is about 8 degrees below zero, according to our guide. He's a guy named Larry Jewell, who says he's been hunting geese for nearly 60 years. Jewell was out in the field even earlier than us, when it was even colder, to set out our decoys. There's about 50 of them, and they look remarkably like real geese. Jewell has them huddled in little clusters around our blind, set up to look like they're eating or sleeping or standing watch, so that real geese flying overhead think, hey, that is a good place to land.
But because I flew helicopters in the Army, I have an appreciation for runways. And the last thing you want on a runway is something on it. You want it all to yourself.
So we're basically making like a goose airport with like a restaurant and a bar and people who are going to shoot them.
They don't know, hopefully, about the people who are going to shoot them.
Decoys are just part of the process. Scott Early pulls out one of the several goose calls he has hanging around his neck. He translates what he's trying to tell the geese.
Please pay attention to me. That was just, hey, I'm here. Give me attention. And that's like a comfort call.
All of this work, the waking up early, setting up the decoys, calling the geese, the process, this is what Early says hunting is about.
And seeing, in this case, a goose lock its wings and come down and come in, and it's a gorgeous, gorgeous sight, and it's like you've done all this work and you've put all this patience and time in, and now it's the fulfillment of it.
But by around 9:30, we are still unfulfilled. I ask Larry Jewell, the guide, why he thinks we haven't yet seen a single Canada goose.
You ever had days when it was a good morning to sleep in?
Yeah, I've had those days.
I think that's what the geese are doing this morning.
You're hunting birds that are pretty well educated. They're usually older birds, so...
Here, Early stops.
Sorry, I thought I heard a goose.
And so the goose calling continues to an empty sky. But the men swap hunting stories, they share jokes, they sip steaming hot coffee. At some point, the conversation turns toward politics. Mike Blasky, the other hunter, points out the shotgun he's carrying isn't all that different from the type of military-style rifles some people want banned.
My gun? Anybody could use a shotgun as a malicious weapon, as well as an assault rifle. But it's not going to be used that way.
For Blasky, his shotgun is practical. Think getting dinner on the table. But for Early, the ex-lawyer, it's also constitutional. Think Minutemen, anti-tyranny, the Second Amendment.
It's very easy to sound paranoid in that discussion, but the short answer to your question is that's the way the amendment was drafted, and it was drafted for a very good reason, because the government knows that it has the citizenry who will not stand for what George Washington called the tyranny of government.
This lofty talk about the Constitution gets me rethinking Early's analogy, how his gun is like his golf clubs.
You know, there isn't a national debate about golf clubs. You can't kill people with a golf club. Most people aren't inclined to.
But your question was about appreciation, and it may be personal attachment because it's been such a useful tool to you. It may be because it has sentimental value. It may be any number of reasons. But it's not the kind of irrational, psychotic lust that a lot of people make it out to be.
Early says before anyone rushes to change gun laws, all of these relationships need to be considered. By mid-afternoon, Early unloads his shotgun to call it a day. Neil Brooks, the owner of the hunt club, rolls up in his SUV to take us back to town, and he has his own theory as to why the geese were a no-show.
I think it might be because they don't want to get shot.
We climb back in the truck, crank the heaters to full blast, and begin to drive out of the cornfield.
So, Scott, could you give us sort of a recap of our day here?
Well, our day was on the one level frustrating because we didn't even see anything fly this morning. But on the other hand, that's what they call it, hunting and not shooting. You never know. And as my father always used to say, you can't shoot them in the living room, so you got to come out and try.
Early says this is the process he enjoys so much. Not a shot fired, but still a good day. I'm Alex Keefe.
Beneath a radio station in Charlotte, North Carolina, is a secret bunker.
I remember being amazed that it would really exist because I thought, you know, in the event of a nuclear attack, we wouldn't be here to broadcast.
Now the station has a new bunker with a new mission. That story later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM 90.9.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home, located at the corner of Elm and University in the historic Trevett Mansion, across from Westside Park in downtown Champaign. Owens Funeral Home, owned and operated by the Owens family since 1925, invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 19th of February, 2013. It's the birthday of Jonathan Lethem, born in New York City, 1964, raised in Brooklyn by radical parents, his mother an activist, his father an avant-garde painter. He went off to Bennington in Vermont, where he said he learned the realities of social class. My parents' bohemian milieu had kept me from understanding even a little that we were poor. The oddity of being raised in a hipster fog where intellectualism and cultural access obscured poverty so completely it became a kind of privilege. He dropped out of college, hitchhiked to the West Coast, worked in bookstores, started to write, and his first big success, a book called Motherless Brooklyn, 1999, about a detective with Tourette's, and then drew from his own experience growing up in a bohemian household in Brooklyn in his novel The Fortress of Solitude. It's the birthday of Carson McCullers, born Lula Carson Smith in Columbus, Georgia, 1917. She was 17 years old when she moved to New York City. She was a classical pianist. She planned to study at Juilliard, but somehow lost her tuition money. Started writing, publishing short stories, got married, moved to North Carolina, worked on a novel, which came out when she was just 23, The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. It was a bestseller. In 1940, she became a celebrity. She had health problems. She and her husband drank a lot and fought a lot. She had a series of strokes starting when she was 24. The first one left her partially paralyzed. In 1953, her husband asked her to take part in a double suicide with him. She declined. He killed himself anyway, and she kept writing. She wrote Reflections in a Golden Eye, The Member of the Wedding, The Ballad of the Sad Cafe. It's the birthday of Amy Tan, born to Chinese immigrant parents in Oakland in 1952. She wrote some short stories that combined to make a sort of novel, which was The Joy Luck Club, a huge bestseller in 1989. Here's a poem for today by Christopher Howell, entitled Dinner Out. We went to either the Canton Grill or the Chinese Village, both of them on 82nd, among the car lots and discount stores and small nests of people waiting hopelessly for the bus. I preferred the Canton for its blackened bright red sign with the dragon leaping out of it and sneezing little pillows of smoke, and inside the beautiful green half-shell booths, glittery brass, encrusted lamps swinging above them. What would I have? Sweet and sour? Chow mein with little wagon wheel-shaped slices of okra and those crinkly noodles my father called deep-fried worms? Fried rice? Among such succulents, what did it matter? We could eat till we were glad and full, the whole family sighing with the pleasure of it. And then the tea, all of this, for about $6 total. My father, for that once in a while, feeling flush in the glow of our happy faces, and asking me, "How you doing, son?" "Fine, Dad. Great, really." In the light of that place, almost tasting the salt and bean paste and molasses, nearly hearing the sound of the car door opening before we climbed in together, and drove